This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 154 was recorded February 14th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. Happy Valentine's Day. Fasanara Capital founder Francesco Filia will join me as this week's feature interview guest. Francesco isn't just bearish. He'll describe the reasons he thinks the market environment is poised for an outright crash. And by the way, the last time he was on this program, he predicted the blow-up of the VIX complex, which occurred several months later. We're long overdue for a post-game chart book and extended equity market discussion, and that's exactly what we'll be bringing you after the feature interview, with a focus on how calendared option straddles can be used to speculate on an eventual downside reversal to new lows in this equity market.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 has just relentlessly advanced. It's almost like no sell-off is lasting more than 24 hours before it's kicking higher again. How much more does this have left in the tank?
Well, that is the operative question, Patrick. And big picture-wise, my view is unchanged from the last several weeks. We have seen the first big wave in a new bear market. Bear markets are punctuated by vicious counter-trend rallies. And boy, if you were caught short, this has been a vicious rally. The thing is, I thought, Patrick, that this was going to last a few more months, and I thought the time to be thinking about getting short the market would be sometime in the second quarter. The thing is, we've already gotten past the 61.8% Fibonacci retrace. We've hit the 200-day moving average. We kind of hit a lot of key technical levels. And I think about the way this market has played out and the calls that we've made in this program. And generally speaking, each time I said, you know, I'm waiting for this or that to happen, and it seems like the downside happens more quickly than we've expected it to. And it makes me think, boy, is it already time to be thinking about shorting the market? And I think it might still be early. It certainly feels early in terms of time, but in terms of price level, you know, we've made a pretty good move. So what I'm particularly interested in is talking to you more in our post-game segment about strategies that we could use to start to ease into a short. You know, I don't want to miss the opportunity to short this market. I think it's going to be a doozy of a downside when it happens, but it also feels a little bit early to me. So how do you make sure you don't miss it? Is there an option position that we can put on in order to position ourselves for maybe getting more short later? Why don't we save that conversation for the post-game segment? But as far as current levels are concerned, I'm watching 2790 because there's an important trend line there. If we get to there, it starts to get really hard for me not to want to express some kind of short on this market. But I'm chicken to go outright short in size in the sense of short S&P futures, just because there's been several times in the last few years that I was sure the bear market was on, and to my own astonishment, we ended up with new all-time highs. So I need to be protected and not just take an outright short. Let's discuss some of the option strategies we can use to accomplish that in postgame.
Sure. So let's move on to the dollar index. And I'll tell you, listen, we've shared with our listeners many times our dollar bull bias. But when we had that big flip-flop from Powell and the dollar started to weaken, it really, in my mind, felt like, at least on the short term, the wind was taken out of the sails of the dollar. But it literally, within 24 to 48 hours after that, the dollar reverses and we're now pushing towards the 52-week highs. What's going on here? Is this where the dollar really breaks out and we get the next big move?
Well, Patrick, I think this has been a textbook rally. As you said, when we got what should have been really bearish news coming out of the flip-flop from Jay Powell, that only lasted a couple of days, and before we knew it, we were moving to new highs above when the Powell news came out. After that, we got all the way up and tested 97 a couple of days ago. That would have been the previous cycle high on a closing basis. It had been higher for just one day on an intraday basis. And there was a little bit of a pullback back down to 96.5. That's natural when you start to run into a resistance level. Already today, we've pushed well above 97 intraday. Looks like we're going to close with a high 96 handle. So to me, this is a textbook rally, and it's happening at a time when the most obvious news in the market was the most bearish news we could have expected coming out of the Fed. And that only lasted a couple of days. So it really says to me that the dollar liquidity squeeze is on. And I think if we break 97.50 on a closing basis, that might open the floodgates for a dramatic move higher.
Let's move on to oil. I want to ask you about those inventories, but I'm also really curious, how much more upside is there? I mean, are we going to do a full retrace of that oil drop? What's on your mind in terms of crude?
Well, my view's changed a little bit, but not a whole lot. What I've been saying for the last several weeks is I think we're in a $45 to $55 consolidation range. And I was expecting the market to roll back over and move lower. And we got down to 51. We found pretty strong support at 51. As I look at the chart going back into the middle of January, early January, there's been quite a few tests of that $51 level that have held. And it held again this week. And of course, Saudi Arabia has helped the market a bit with their jawboning about supposedly making further production cuts. Frankly, I think that what Saudi Arabia says publicly is designed for public consumption. I don't think it has a whole lot of direct relationship to what they're really doing, but it certainly helped the market higher. Now, what I was going to say today is, look, we're still kind of holding here at this 54.50 level. I think that could be forming the right shoulder on a short-term head and shoulders pattern. The opposite argument you could make is that we're flirting with the neckline on a longer-term inverse head and shoulders pattern. So it depends on how you want to read that chart. But I was thinking, it looks to me like we're about to roll back over to the downside. The thing that has kind of thrown me a little bit for a loop this afternoon on Thursday is, although the WTI contract still looks to me like it's about to roll over, I look at RBOB gasoline really breaking out today above $1.50. That's a big move, and it was unexpected, at least to me. Oftentimes, RBOB gasoline is a leading indicator of what WTI is going to do next. And so as I look at the rest of the energy complex, it really puts a question mark in my mind. Maybe we are about to move higher after all. I wasn't expecting that, but again, the RBOB is the tell there, so we'll see what happens. So far, the WTI chart doesn't look super bullish to me. If we were to get a daily close above 55, 57, that would definitely say to me, okay, we're seeing an upside breakout that I had not expected in WTI. Hasn't come there yet, but the early warning sign has come from RBOB gasoline. As far as inventory this week, should have been bearish news. Crude oil building 3.6 million barrels nationwide. That was against analyst expectations of about a 2 million barrel build. Now, Cushing, Oklahoma was a drawdown of about a million barrels. There was a spill that required a short-term shutdown of the Keystone pipeline, and I think that probably has to do with the reason that Cushing is experiencing this anomalous drawdown when everything else has been builds across the board. Gasoline and distillates both building this week. Gasoline, 746,000 barrels. Distillates, 1.2 million barrels. Production unchanged at 11.9 million barrels domestic U.S. production, and that is, of course, an all-time record for U.S. production. In general, the market, as I said, is stronger than I expected. It's the RBOB action this afternoon that really has me wondering if maybe I got it wrong thinking that we were going to top out at 55 here. So far, though, WTI is following the plan that I had in mind.
All right, Eric. Well, let's move on to gold, because at the tail end of January, we started that rip above 1300. And even though gold has been consolidating for pretty much 2 weeks, it's holding the line. The buyers are defending that price above 1300 very well. I mean, is there still one more leg higher in gold coming in spite of the dollar strength?
Well, that's really the story, is in spite of the dollar strength, we've seen more examples of up days where gold and the dollar are up on the same day. So I still like the pairs trade that we discussed, long gold and long the dollar. I was waiting for a pullback to 1300. I thought we'd get it. We only got down to 1302 or so. And, you know, now it looks like, as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, we're about 1306, 1307. So maybe I missed the dip, and was aiming a little bit too low. We'll see what happens, but certainly gold is holding its own, and it's holding its own in the face of a rapidly increasing dollar, and that really says to me that that pairs trade is working.
Eric, finally, I want to touch on the 10-year Treasury yield. Right after the retail sales, we saw us turn back down, and we're seeing the yields heading down to 2.66. What's the direction in yields from here in your mind?
I still think that we're slowly trending lower. 260 is a key level that I'm waiting to see us trade below. We were below it for a couple of days. I think 257 or 256 or something was a low print. I want to see a sustained close below 260 that lasts for a week. We haven't seen that yet. Aside from that, I don't think there's anything new to report, and I don't really have strong conviction here with regard to Treasury yields. I've been a little bit surprised by a few of the turns, so I'm just waiting to see what happens next.
Eric, let's come back to the 10-year Treasury yield in the postgame. So this week's featured interview guest is Francesco Filia. Eric, why did we invite Francesco back as this week's interview guest?
Well, Francesco really nailed the call on the VIX, and we usually give Chris Cole credit for that. In reality, Francesco was the first person on this program to really make that prediction that the VIX complex was going to blow up. He made it a few months before Chris did. Chris made that prediction the week before it happened, which made it seem incredibly predictive, although Chris would be the first to admit that this is something he's been predicting for years. And in general, Francesco's always had a very interesting macro perspective. I wanted to get him on now because he has what to me is a surprisingly bearish view. I share his bearish view. He's not talking about bear market, normal bear market. He's talking about outright crash, 2008, 1987 style of crash. And I was particularly curious to understand why he sees that scenario as opposed to more of a garden variety bear market that takes a year and a half to play out, which was a little bit more of the scenario that I was thinking of. I think we should also be looking, Patrick, for someone who's a really strong equity bull in this environment. I'd love to get Marco Kolanovic on the program to talk about his views, because he certainly is a very well-respected analyst who is calling now for new all-time highs. So I'm trying to get as many different contrasting views, and I particularly wanted to get Francesco on to talk about why he's not just bearish, but he's actually looking at crash scenarios.
Eric's interview with Francesco Filia is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Francesco Filia from Fasanara Capital. Francesco, thank you so much for coming back on the program. Before we get into your slide deck, which listeners can find the download link for in the Research Roundup email or on the homepage, you can look next to Francesco's picture if you're not yet registered for the button that says looking for the downloads. We do have a great slide deck coming up, but before we even get into that, I want to just remind our listeners that the first time that we interviewed Francesco on this program, his prediction was a blow up in the VIX complex. Now, we tend to give a lot of credit to Chris Cole for making that call. Really, Chris is the guy who made that call the week before it happened on this program, and it just felt so timely. But if you go back and listen to Francesco's interview from several months earlier, he really predicted the same thing. So, Francesco, congratulations. You got the call right on the volatility complex blowing up as it did back in February of 2018. Now, as I begin to look at your slide deck, as I get into slide three here, you're really looking for what sounds like not just maybe things are going to weaken, but you're really looking for significant downside, a crash or a serious bear market. First of all, am I correct to characterize that that's what you're saying here? And if so, why do you see that coming?
Thank you, Eric, for inviting me again. It's great to be back. And yes, it's correct. We are particularly bearish these days in the market. We've really been bearish already for 2 years. We see the probability rising of a major market correction. And, you know, you hear from various market participants that there is the risk of a recession hitting the United States, and there is the risk of a multi-quarters bear market emanating out of it. And I believe it is a clear possibility. But our own theory is more, let's say, more dramatic than that, and has got to do with the market downfall, which happens in a more limited amount of time, which could really be a market crash. According to our theories, the markets in December last year were really going very close to the cliff, and they could have seen a much more violent downturn. And for much more violent downturn, we speak about a market event, defining the market event as a drop in the S&P by more than 40% from the peak being around 2,900, which was touched in September last year. Such market event was very close to happen. It would have equated to an S&P diving fast below 2,000 and at levels as low as 1,500, possibly. So re-seeing and retesting the lows of a few years back. I think that our view was wrong in December because it did not happen, but it could happen again. You know, what we saw in December and also what we saw in February was really a preview, a spoiler alert in a way of what may come later on. We think that the market setup is preparing such a potential downfall. Most of our bearishness is not linked to any specific trigger in the market, but has more got to do with the structure itself of the market, which we say and which we have analyzed to be very, very inflammable, very concentrated across a small number of positions and all being very long beta and very short volatility. And the consequence of that high intercorrelation between investment strategies on a few large juggernaut actors in the asset management industry results into a very deep and definitive market fragility, which we think may play out soon at some point over the next year or two and may lead to a market downfall. The typical investor behavior is to look for triggers and for the cause-effect relationship. What we try to do is a little bit different. So in addition to looking at each of the components of the market, going from overvaluations for bonds and equities to over-indebtedness of the system, going into the end of effectiveness for quantitative easing, in addition to look at the companies, we tend to apply a conceptual framework, which is using a complexity theory. So the analysis of complex dynamic systems. And by analyzing the system as a whole, as opposed to its components, we think that there is a lot that can be learned. And in particular, what one can learn is tools that they can help predict the proximity to a market crash, so the proximity to a major downfall, utilizing some of the teachings of complexity theory. And this is what this presentation is all about and the slide deck that I sent through.
Well, I want to push back on one aspect of this. First of all, with respect to being bearish on the stock market, you're preaching to the choir, and certainly a lot of our smartest guests that we've had on this program have said a lot of the same things. End of the business cycle, late cycle dynamics, so many signs in terms of the yield curve almost inverting and then bouncing as it typically does before you get into real trouble. There's so many reasons to be bearish. So you're preaching to the choir there, but you're not just bearish. You're talking about an event which you believe would be short duration, a sudden crash, as opposed to, let's say, a multi-year bear market. Why specifically do you think that the ingredients are there for a crash that plays out quickly, as opposed to a period of several years of, you know, weakening market conditions?
Again, I'm bearish, and I would also be fine with a multi-quarter and multi-year bearish market of the classical type. But I believe that we are into a market situation which resembles what we have seen during the Lehman years, what you've seen during 1929, to a lesser extent what we have seen during 1987, and to a lesser extent also to what we have seen in 2007 during the so-called quant quake. So what we have in front of us is a one-of-a-kind market environment, which has got common features to all of those big market crashes in the market, which have happened in a fast fashion. And I think, therefore, that the shape and tempo can be similar to those in unfolding very quickly and very violently. If you remember, you know, most of our bearishness, again, is based on the market structure, right? So to the fact that there is so much of a low diversity, everybody in the market doing the same things after a long, prolonged period of market, rigged markets, really, you know, heavily affected by quantitative monetary policies, but also by negative interest rate policies and zero interest rate policies. And this monumental intervention in the market has created all sorts of positive feedback loops, all sorts of reflexive behavior on the side of private investors, including also the passive strategies. But effectively, a lot of these strategies have become passive or quasi-passive, with different level of stiffness to their decision-making process. So they're all quite automatic based on what happens. And this goes from risk parity to risk premium, to ETFs, to low volatility vehicles, to CTA, trend following, factor investing, and all the sorts. So we think that if you look at the market structure itself, in a way, it is really very close to a tipping point, and we think that this could cause the most severity of the issue. And if you look at the past, the analogy that we like the most is the one of 2007, although it didn't survive for very long at the time. But in August of 2007, there was the so-called quant quake. It was a point in time in which some quant-driven strategies lost 30% in a very short fashion, in a number of few days. They were very lucky to then recover that fallout. But, you know, still to date, nobody really exactly knows why they lost so much so quickly, including also, you know, the very famed Goldman Sachs quant fund. And that gives the idea on a small scale of what can happen when the structure of the market is concentrated and is overexposed to a few trades only. Something happens on one corner of the world and there's implications and effects all across. And we think that this is very relevant right now. On the other end, we apply complexity theory. I mean, I'm not a theorist, but I'm really only trying to be a complexity thinker in a way, which is really the analysis of systems in transition. And so you should read the three systems in transitions as the probability of materializing of a systemic risk. So systemic risk is really the probability for this system, the market system, to go into a transition, which means a very sudden change, a chaos outburst, something really violent and really material. And if you look at this market system as a whole, forgetting about the single components of this system, you can recognize a few of these commonalities to systems in transitions. And in our analysis and in our also quant research, we have analyzed a few of these features. And so there are quite a few things that they tick the box of systems in transition. And this is really something which is non-traditional. You know, the traditional way of looking at the markets is to look at indicators such as PE, price earnings multiples when it comes to equity, or other traditional measures when it comes to the debt market in terms of net debt on EBITDA or debt on a GDP metrics when you talk about a government. And all of those are quite traditional measures that they can always be taken into account. But what we think is really dangerous today is that you have a synchronicity across a number of potential dimensions of expansion of the system. And when the system cannot expand anymore, in terms of valuations, in terms of over-indebtedness, in terms of quantitative easing, when the system cannot expand any longer, it starts to behave very weirdly. So it starts to show problems and goes into trouble and potentially into a phase transition zone, which is what really can give most of the trouble. So just to make an example, you have today a twin bubble. So like you have simultaneously a bubble in equities in the US and a bubble in bonds in Europe and in Japan. Bonds in Europe and in Japan, they're trading at negative yields or zero yields. Equities in the US is still trading at the CAPE multiples, Shiller adjusted multiples, which are very close to 30. So they're still very, very expensive. So differently than in 1929, for example, or differently than in 2007, here you have a moment of overvaluations which combines equities and bonds. In 2007, you had one or two buffers that they could soften the impact of market turbulence and of a big market crash. The first buffer in 2007 was bonds themselves. The valuation on bonds could expand further. So the yields could drop, and therefore the price of bonds could rise. And that was a buffer for portfolios. It was a buffer for balanced portfolios, because at the time in which investors were losing on the equity side, they could make money on the bond side. And that in systems theory parlance is a buffer. So it's something that saves the day at a moment of a great panic. The same was true also, by the way, in 1987, when the market fell by 20 and then 30%, interest rates that had just gone up to 10%, they dropped to 7%. So there was a rally on bonds as the equity movement materialized. The other thing that could happen in 2007 that cannot happen today, or the other couple of things, one is quantitative easing. You know, at the time it could be introduced, such an extraordinary monetary policy lever. Today, it wouldn't be the same, because it would be QE4, already the fourth edition, for something which has got a very famous decreasing marginal capacity to impact growth and also the stock market itself. And three, in 2007, you had the debt that could expand further, especially at the public entities level. It was a problem having to do with the private sector. And now the problem got transferred into the public sector. But at the same time, you had the expansion potential on the debt side, which today you don't have. So today, if there is a market crash in equities, it's going to be much more damaging to everybody, to most of the balanced portfolios, because the bonds, they cannot rally, because the central bank cannot intervene in the same shape and fashion, or it can still, but not at the same, not yielding the same type of effectiveness and results. And at the same time, debt is also a problem of its own. So even the dimension of expansion into over-indebtedness is not available. And that's why we are looking at systemic risk today in a very serious way. And we think a systemic risk today is higher than it has been in the past, including the Lehman crisis.
You've got an excellent series of charts and graphs to support the many excellent points that you're making. I encourage our listeners to peruse them at their leisure. But I'm going to skip ahead in the interest of time to slide number 16 in your deck, where you talk on the title about tipping points, crash hallmarks, and butterflies. Talk us through this. If we take the arguments that you've just made, it looks like what you're saying here is you've got to really look for where are the signals and triggers that are going to tell you when a big move is likely to happen. Talk us through this and maybe the next couple of slides where you describe this process.
Absolutely. This is our conceptual framework. So it is utilizing complexity theory. As I said, I would probably term it complexity markets or complexity finance. And like in terms of why is it relevant, I would say that we are used in the market parlance and to utilize a traditional asset-based metrics. That is really a result of, if you wish, the efficient market hypothesis. The efficient market hypothesis has been with us for more than a century, but was really introduced in the 60s. And according to the efficient market hypothesis, all information are embedded into market prices. And you can look at the investor behavior as being efficient and rational. And thinking about the efficient market hypothesis, you get into a territory where you can think of PE multiples for equities, you can think at net debt on EBITDA or debt on equity ratios for public debt, for example, and so on and so forth. Thinking about it, for example, you can identify today that there is a huge problem with leverage loans in the US, for example, or junk bonds plus leverage loans plus CLOs. But that is still very traditional way to look at the markets. Efficient market hypothesis has been proven to be flawed, because they could really not justify what happened, for example, during the Lehman crisis. A big improvement to the efficient market hypothesis has occurred with behavioral finance. In the last five or six Nobel Prize for Economics have often been behavioral scientists like Robert Shiller, Akerlof, Kahneman, Taylor, the most recent one. And they clearly do something about enriching the efficient market hypothesis, because they talk about mental quirks in the investor community, things like the recency bias, the Monte Carlo bias, the hot hand bias, and things like that they can justify investors doing irrational things. What we think is still missing, moving from efficient market hypothesis to behavioral finance, is complexity theory. Complexity theory helps a great deal, because you look at the whole all of a sudden, and the components of the systems are no longer the primary focus, but you look at the whole. Looking at the whole, you have this slide here, which means that you should look at saturation points for the system as a whole. Once you have reasons to believe that the system has reached a saturation point, then you look at the early warning signals. So you look at those signals that they can come in confirmation of your theory. If they do confirm your theory, then only at the end you look for the triggers that they can kick in the autolytic effect, so they can kick in a market crash, for example. And the triggers are of the traditional nature. So it can be leveraged loans in the US, it can be the Fed hiking interest rates, it can be China going into trouble as they have more than $1 trillion of dollar-denominated or foreign-denominated bonds to roll within the next year or two. But all of those are traditional indicators, and they come only at the end of the analysis. Before everything else, you look at the system, and this is what the tipping point analysis does, and it's really the next slide, slide number 17. And what the slide 17 does is the tipping point analysis. So to look at the potential direction of expansion of a system, those direction of expansion, they can allow a system to not go into transition for a while longer. So to postpone the day of acknowledgement, of the day of reckoning for the market saturation. But the problem is when all of those happen at the same time. And this is to provide a framework to understand what are those dimensional expansions, what is able to buy time for the market system as a whole. And obviously, you have things like valuations. You know, for example, as I said, during the Lehman crash, bonds could save the day because bonds could still expand in valuation terms. They could still rally. Yields could still fall. Today, you have a problem of twin bubbles. You have not only equities, which are overvalued, especially the largest equity bucket in the world, which is U.S. equities, but also bonds are overvalued, especially the largest bond universe in the world after the U.S., which is Japan and the European markets. And so you have a problem of valuations. This alone could be a reason for many market participants to call the bubble and therefore the risk of a sell-off. But this is not to be taken in isolation. What really matters is the synchronicity of this risk on valuation when coupled with, for example, debt. Debt on its own is dangerous enough. Here you have many metrics that can be called upon, right? You have Rogoff and Reinhard debt saturation points and debt tolerance limits. You have the BIS debt metrics. You have the Minsky point of the Heyman-Minsky of 1977. And obviously, they also give a sense of where, you know, over-indebtedness cannot expand anymore because it cannot even pay for the interest payments on the previous debt, let alone debt repayment. All of those metrics are relevant, but I believe that they are even more relevant when they are coupled with valuations, and then when they're coupled also with the rest. What could save the day if valuations are too expensive or debt is too high? Quantitative easing. Quantitative easing is an external agent, and if you look at it from the viewpoint of systems theory, it's really the second law of thermodynamics, which says that within an isolated system, entropy always rises or never falls, which means really that things tend to become more chaotic over time, unless there is an external agent like quantitative easing after the Lehman crash. And what you have seen is that after the Lehman crash, there was a big rally because QE could be introduced. Bonds, in the meantime, had rallied, so they had saved some of the pain, and debt could still expand. Today, you have a problem because all of the three, they seem to be hitting capacity constraint. So the system becomes saturated, and at some point, keeps a lot of potential energy. At some point, after the tipping point, the critical threshold has been surpassed, then there is a problem because there is a potential for transition. Cash, at the end, cash is also another potential expansion of the system. If you want to save the day, maybe you should spend some of the cash that is on the sidelines. And here in our research, we prove or we try to show that there is not as much cash on the sidelines as it is often portrayed. In the next slide, page 18, here you have the basin of attraction. So if you look at the market as a complex system, in systems theory, you typically indicate the state of the market as a red ball within a basin of attraction. And if you look at the left-hand side, you have the basin of attraction after Lehman, you could say, where there was a valuation expansion capacity, primarily on bonds, and when there was also debt expansion capacity. So debt potential for expansion made for a very wide basin of attraction, which means a very stable system, and a system that was not easy to go into trouble again. At some point, you have the QE tsunami that was pushing the state of the systems into an unstable equilibrium, which is the picture on the right, where you don't have any more potential expansions for bonds because bonds have hit the zero bound. So there is very little to argue around it, right? Bonds, they cannot rally. That is already by itself, for most balanced portfolios, they have lost a big measure of buffer against systemic risk. And not many of the retail investors, for example, have appreciated how much of a problem there is in that space. They are still seeing, from the last couple of years, capital gains on the bond portfolios, which are purely results of rates having gone below zero. And they still expect that capital gains to be able to reproduce themselves in the future, which is never going to happen for mathematical reasons, because rates cannot dip below zero by much and for long. And then the other measure of expansion is debt deleverage, right? So the debt cannot expand any further, and the cash is, for the most part, spent, which means, from a systems theory, that there is low resilience and the high risk of critical transformation. And this is what the tipping point analysis does. And effectively, it's a way to visualize the systemic risk in the systems by looking at its various potential direction of expansion.
Okay, help me understand specifically why the tipping points or the triggers are right now. Because if I go back to slide 17 and look at these various different bubbles you have here, okay, cash stretched, everybody's all in. That's been true for 2 or 3 years. Valuation stretched to ridiculous levels. That's been true for 2 or 3 years. Debt stretched beyond belief. That's been true for 2 or 3 years. Feds out of bullets. That's been true for 2 or 3 years. And to my astonishment, the market hasn't crashed yet. So it seems like you think something has changed and it's finally upon us. What specifically is telling you that now is the time?
I thought the time was last year or even the year before. I was wrong, obviously. But, you know, the reason why I was wrong, I believe, you know, to justify myself, is because of the tax cuts from the Trump administration. So, for example, on slide 29, we speak about that. And we equated that to doping. You know, the tax cuts had an effect to impact the market in a way in which it did by boosting earnings for companies and therefore mathematically, you know, pushing stocks even higher and buying time for the market to postpone further this day of reckoning. You see in this chart, for example, this amazing disconnect between the unemployment rate and the fiscal deficits on GDP, which is something that is not easy to see. This slide, this chart dates back 70 years. And there has always been a pretty decent correlation between the two. And it's amazing, astonishing, the spread out, the disconnect that we are currently seeing. It has got to do, in my personal opinion, in addition to monetary steroids, late in the cycle, you had the fiscal steroids. And the market took it in. And that the immediate effect was also, for example, the tax reform had a further effect on buybacks. Buybacks in total within the last several years in the U.S. have been in excess of $5 trillion. So it is a very decent measure. Now, buybacks have probably run out of steam because the leverage ratio of the U.S. corporates are worse than in the pre-Lehman period, and also because you know, valuations are more excessive. But I believe that for the last couple of years, you can make the point that that was really what was keeping the market afloat and postponing the day of reckoning. In page 27, this is a slide that we call early warning signals. We go into describing why we think this is going to be ahead of us and not too far in time. I wouldn't say imminent because to me, if it happens this month or next year, is irrelevant, right? You know, if it is about to happen, whatever you do in between times is going to be like picking dimes in front of a steamroller, right? You know, so like to me, not to be sure about the day and the week and the month is irrelevant, right? It's still, if your determination is that we live within a systemic risk, the rational decisions should be to step out if you are, you know, most of the market participants, or to be short if you are somebody like us that want to capitalize and bank on the market event, but surely not to keep being long. The fact that most of the institutionalized asset management world stays long is not really because they don't believe in this view, but it's because, you know, they are not paid to spot a bubble, which is part of the reason why systemic risk typically tends to compound and reach the stage until which the bubble goes into deflation and it can be a deflationary bust.
Let's talk about how this would actually play out and what the consequences would be in other markets. Let's suppose that your scenario of a stock market, either a dramatic bear market sell-off or an outright crash where we go dramatically lower in equity prices. Now, historically, the normal situation when that happens is that bonds rally just tremendously because the safety trade is out of equities and into treasury bonds. But when treasury bonds are already in a bubble, as you described earlier in this interview, where does that leave us? Does that still mean that bonds are the benefactor, or is there a potential that they both end up selling off? And if they're both selling off, where does the money go? What goes up?
So, first of all, typically when the equity market sells off, the bonds rally, right? Unless if bonds have rallied the most already, and unless most of the rally potential is behind them, which is typically the case for bonds in Europe and in Japan. In the US, you can argue that bonds can still rally because they can reach the zero level and also go negative. You know, the US is the largest bond market, but not by far when compared with the European bond market and the Japanese bond market. So like for a lot of balanced portfolios globally, you know, the bond rally is not able to help by much, A. And B, it could even be, as you say, that the bonds, they don't rally. Because let's not forget that bonds given a fundamental analysis of bonds, they should react to where GDP is, to where inflation and inflation expectations and inflation premia on top of it are. And these days, you could make the argument that the deflationary boom and then now the deflationary bust has already occurred. And there could be a moment in time in which we see inflation picking up. If anybody's to judge by the Taylor rule or if anybody's to judge by the job market, there could be a case to be made that inflation has bottomed. Also, what I like to mention is that, obviously, the other time where inflation seemed dead and then all of a sudden it was on a rising path was at the end of the 19th century, when similarly to today, you had the deglobalization, so you had that the globalization was losing steam, and all of a sudden you were talking about the trade barriers, the trade wars, and the trade confrontations, a period that eventually led to the First World War. And you see that in a moment of time like this, it could well be that inflation picks up. The other possibility for inflation to pick up and therefore forbidding bonds from saving the day and so provoking a sell-off in bonds at the same time as equity sell-off is clearly has got to do with the quantitative easing. It has been rumored by various parts that the next shape and form of QE may not be money to banks for them to buy govies, mortgages, and sometimes equities like in Switzerland and Japan. But it may be people's QE, so a QE which is more intended to provide for a universal basic income, for example, given the shape that populism is taking across the globe, including most recently in France. And I believe that that also possibility, if the market was ever to discount that in advance, would definitely equate to more inflation across the globe. And a big inflation scare could definitely be one of the all bets are off type scenario, right? If for any reason tomorrow there was a bad inflation print out of the US or Japan or Europe, I believe it would be serious trouble for the markets because all of a sudden bonds would be in the doghouse and the equities would surely, in my opinion, react very negatively to that.
Francesco, for aggressive investors like yourself who are comfortable speculating on the short side of equities, where do you think the play is? Is it in the S&P? Is it in the NASDAQ? Is it individual issues like Tesla, say, that a lot of people think is very overvalued? How do you play this if you are willing to speculate on the short side?
Well, there are a few things that you can do. Now, we believe that the market may fall in a fashion where it's going to be very difficult to capture the moment. What we have is like a five pillars investment strategy, which tries to cover all potential scenarios, or at least these five potential scenarios, where the big downfall materializes. And some of them have got to do with, shorts outrights. And those short outrights, yes, they are involved primarily in equities on U.S. markets. So we look at the S&P, we look at the NASDAQ. Outside of it, we look at the Nikkei, and we look at the DAX in Europe. So I would say pretty much scattered across. We also have idiosyncratic stories in the commodity space, in the energy and power space, which have got to do with the single stocks. Then we have another couple of pillars which have got to do with the volatility, right? So we are long volatility because typically in a downward scenario, volatility picks up, except if it is a flash crash. There is also the theoretical possibility that the market readjusts to the downside, let's say 20% off, 30% off in a short fashion, and does not pick up from it, which means that the volatility, yes, it picks up, but not by much, which is really what happened in the last quarter of last year, where differently than in February last year, the market tanked, but volatility did not pick up. VIX was really only at 20, and so it was not measuring much happening on the vol side. So that is also to say that we cannot trust vol alone to save the day if a big crash in the market materializes. So then we do all sorts of different things. So, for example, we do what we call gamma replica. So we try to replicate the profiles of puts by replicating the building blocks of puts in the market without spending all of the premium upfront. And then we do also, and this is the fifth pillar of the strategy, we look for fragile ETFs. What are those? Those are ETFs, instruments, or other passive traded instruments, which have oversold liquidity and diversification. So the so-called ETFs that have fake liquidity and fake diversification. Last year, for example, the XIV ETP was one such example, where in February, very quickly, VIX went on a single day in February from 13 to 20, closing the day at 20. We expected at 20 to see the ETF being withdrawn to have a major liquidity event and an early termination event. And so it happened that after the cash close, in the space of a quarter of an hour, VIX traded contracts were in excess of 280,000, which was five times the previous peak historical, and that instrument was retired. That ETF or ETP was a fragile ETP, so it was not designed to sustain a certain market event. And that is only one spoiler alert for many more things to happen that could happen to a lot more instruments which have typically oversold diversification and liquidity. And so we have a screening of 10, 15 of them which are going to run into trouble if there is really a market environment for the market to go down 20-30% in a short duration.
There's a backdrop of changing politics behind all of this. If I look at what's going on in the United States now, we see younger generations favoring socialism over capitalism very openly. The Democratic Party is moving toward the Democratic Socialist Party of America. We see in Europe the Yellow Vest movement. It seems like populism is on the rise, and there is definitely a trend toward more socialist thinking in what younger generations want from government, an attitude of acceptance of larger government and more control by government. How do these things, these trends, fit into your overall investment thesis and market outlook?
Well, they do very much because, in a way, we thought quantitative easing was... let me say that populism is definitely the elephant in the room. I remember a chart, a trend line that we put in one of our research notes that was basically showing the linear trend of rising populism, particularly in Europe at the time, but was really a global phenomenon. It was a chart from 2015, and it was showing that by the following year, which was 2016, the trend line was expected to cross 50%. And if you look at the chart, what happened in 2016, obviously you had Trump in the US, you had Brexit in Europe, you had a failed Italian referendum already at the end of 2016, if I'm not mistaken. And if you are to judge from that linear interpolation, you would say that populism today is around 60 to 70%. And guess what? In countries such as Italy, it is indeed at 60%. If you couple the voting polls for the Northern League and the other political party at the government, you sum them up at 60%. So you are well in excess of 60%. And so this is clearly a global phenomenon. What I would say is that populism is due to some structural forces at play. It has got to do with globalization or the extreme version of globalization which has been proposed in the last 10 years. It has to do with the fourth industrial revolution, so to this new world where a lot of the middle class is not anymore useful prospectively for the future. But it has got also to do with monetary policy making. It has got to do with the twin bubbles in equities and bonds. It has got to do with the quantitative easing, creating all these financial assets inflation and making the rich richer and the poor the same as before. So relatively speaking, poorer than before. And two measures for that, two examples for it. 2016 was a very good year for Microsoft because they could spend in buybacks $40 billion. They could boost the dividend. And yet, during the same year, they shed 10,000 jobs. So this is an example that should be taken into account. There is a long list of similar situations of companies where the trickle-down economics really failed and where the portfolio channel theory of Ben Bernanke clearly failed. And this should be taken into account. And the other example that I would put at disposal is the fact that today in the U.S., the median house costs $300,000. The median wage is only $30,000. So it is 10 times the wage what you need to spend to buy a house. It was only two in 1950. So obviously, there is a problem today. And when it comes, if you go out of the realm of politics and you stick to market commentary, when it comes to market commentary and policy making, we should admit that at no point in recent years a certain decision of policy making has been linked to populism or to income inequality, right? So the policymakers, they never ask themselves at this very stage if a certain measure like QE4 or QE forever out of the US, out of the Federal Reserve, for example, would increase or decrease income inequality. And I think it's about time that it does. I think that question should be openly asked to policymakers, or I think it should be in the utility function of policymakers before they decide to do something to ask themselves, am I going to increase one of the big fault line of the system right now, which is income inequality, or am I going to decrease it? And the decision should be taken only once that is taken into account, which is not clearly happening right now. So definitely social risk in the form of populism can create a regime change which can unfold in various different ways. I think that the most easy to predict for the future, and this is a research of ours from 2016, is for universal basic income and people's QE, as it has been called. It is very likely, if the current stagnant growth outlook stays, for QE to have a different shape and form for the future. So to happen again, but in a different format. And if it happens in that different format, it's surely going to be inflationary. It's surely not going to be so benign to asset prices, because it can equate it to a lower bond market and a troubled equity market.
So if we were to see, and it sounds like your expectations are very in line with my own, at some point, if there were calls where the populist outcry was too strong and people just said, look, if we're going to conjure money out of thin air, it should be helicopter money, QE for the people, and it should come in the form of payments to people in need, not bailouts for Wall Street. And if that were rigidly enforced by various countries around the world, if they were all to experience a change where people just demanded that, it sounds like inflation is the most immediate and obvious risk. What other consequences would exist in financial markets for various different asset classes were that to occur?
Well, look, we typically think that we have never seen it before and stuff like that. But really, the problem with income inequality dates back centuries and centuries, if not millennia, right? And there is this nice book of Will Durant, which is called The Lessons of History, in which he says that progressive societies, they very often reach a point where the strengths of the number in the many poor rivals the strengths of the ability in the few rich, right? Because it's normal for income inequality to materialize because the skill distribution is different. But then at some point, this tipping point is reached when there is an unstable equilibrium, which generates a critical situation. So almost like if Durant was like a complexity theorist. And at that point, two things can happen. Either the legislation redistributes the wealth, or the revolution redistributes the poverty. It seems like now we are at a crossroad, right, where the revolution is kind of unfolding, but it would be better for everybody. Or you could have the legislation which redistributes the wealth in the form of people's QE, for example. I think, look, I don't have the answer to your question nailed down, but I think that definitely inflation is the biggest spectrum out there. Because if you include this income inequality decompression with trade wars and more nationalism, as it is, I think, only at the beginning, we are just at the beginning of this trend globally, starting with the US-China confrontation, but it's really only at the beginning. And I think that if you couple the two things, inflation is really the big scare out there. Also because it's going to eat on bonds trading at zero yield. So for the Bund 10-year government bond, which currently trades at 10 basis points over LIBOR, just 10 basis points, to double up or move tenfold, it takes very little, right? So the amount of damage that can emanate from that is really, really strong. The other risk that I see has got to do with the US dollar. So if these trade wars, they materialize, if it is true that income inequality is going to decompress because at some point, people will want to avoid a revolution, then there is an issue also with the US dollar because, in my opinion, the US dollar is already on a path of strengthening, approaching 97 as we speak. But, I think that the US dollar, typically the US dollar has represented 25% of global trade flows, but 60-70% of global reserves, FX reserves. And so typically the idea is that as this redistribution of reserves happens, the dollar gets weaker. I believe that the opposite long-term trend can take place, where the dollar becomes much stronger as a consequence of deleverage happening in the US. It's not happened yet. As a consequence of trade wars, as a consequence also of the fact that it's not going to be as heavily utilized as it has been right now to the benefit of other currencies, including the Chinese renminbi. So the stronger US dollar has all sorts of negative implications for a lot of asset classes, right, including emerging markets, commodity plays, and other things. So I think that is another thing, if you ask me, that needs to be taken into account.
Well, Francesco, I cannot thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Before I let you go, please tell our listeners where they can follow your work at Fasanara Capital and learn more about what you do there.
Well, we have everything online on our website, which is fasanara.com. We publish our research notes and our quantitative indicators, which they try to detect the proximity to a cliff, the proximity to a systemic risk, which we call the system level resilience indicators. And, you know, we are not very public about our investment strategies. You will not find much on the web, but please reach out if you want to hear more.
Thank you so much, Francesco. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Francesco back on the show. I really love the idea of mixing complexity theory in the way that you approach the markets. So it's always interesting to hear his views there. Where I wanted to push back a little bit on is that I don't know whether I feel that the opportunity in bonds, like one of the big things that I got out of the interview was his idea that bonds aren't going to be there to act as that alternative asset to the equity markets, which makes the risk to the markets that much greater. But, you know, Francesco obviously is based out in London and has a strong European background. I mean, I'm just wondering whether that situation is very much, much more the case in Europe, where their yields are already near zero. And the idea that their bonds could have a big rally from here is really a moot point. It's just simply not a realistic expectation. But then when I think back to that interview we had with Alex just last week, I mean, he made a pretty compelling case that there is still an enormous opportunity in U.S. Treasury bonds. And I tend to be in Alex's camp there, where I think that Treasury bond yields can still gravitate towards zero and that there is still room for Treasury bonds to rally. And so this is where I don't know whether I see eye to eye with Francesco's view. What's your takeaway on that?
Well, Patrick, I think a key to this, as you said, is to keep in mind that Francesco is in Europe and European sovereign debt is more overpriced than U.S. sovereign debt. At the same time, you know, it's been higher than it is now. Yields have been more negative than they have been now, so it's not impossible to go there. And I think that in an abrupt market sell-off scenario, if the market's crashing, a lot of that money that's coming out of people that are panicking out of the stock market is going to go back into sovereigns, and a lot of institutional money in Europe will go into European sovereigns and push even further, deeper negative yields. Now, to me, that sets up a speculative opportunity. I think that in that scenario of a stock market crash, if Francesco is right that the stock market crash is coming, just from a mandate perspective, a lot of institutions are going to be forced into European sovereign debt, pushing even deeper negative bond yields and negative yields on other European sovereign debt. To me, that would be the entry opportunity for the short trade on European sovereigns. But frankly, I even wonder if that's something that I would want to pursue, because at least so far, what we're seeing is European junk debt is yielding less than U.S. treasuries. So why wouldn't you just look at the pairs trade, shorting European junk long U.S. treasuries, with equal yield? Eventually, that disparity in quality has got to get resolved. So I think there's a lot of interesting fixed income trades that are setting up from these inefficiencies. I'm just not sure when they happen. But I agree with you. There's a big disparity between U.S. and European sovereigns in terms of how they're priced.
Well, you can definitely talk to Bill Gross about that long short combination, because he's not doing too well on his short bonds long treasury combination. But anyway, I put up a weekly chart. So now our listeners that have access to the chart book, we put together a post game chart book that you'll find linked in the research roundup email as well as on the website. And what I have here is a chart of the 10-year futures on weekly chart on the treasury bonds. And what I wanted to just illustrate was this idea that, well, what if Alex Gurevich scenario starts to develop and we saw not only short-term interest rates gravitate back to zero, let's say Powell is done and eventually has to start cutting, and subsequently we see that the 10-year treasury yield continues to gravitate lower in unison. I wanted to just illustrate that if we just returned back to the same yields we saw back in 2016 and 2013 on the 10-year yield, we would have about a 10% upside on treasury bonds. And even if they gravitate like in Europe towards zero, which I'm not necessarily forecasting, I mean, there could be a 20% upside on 10-year treasury bonds in the coming years. So I personally think that there's still room for them to behave in a safe haven manner if, in fact, we're in a bear market.
Well, Patrick, something we should mention just for sake of clarity is this chart is a price chart, the price of the bonds. We're looking at 10-year treasury note futures prices. Price trades inverse to yield. So the lower numbers on this chart are higher yields and the higher numbers are lower yields. And the other point that I would make, Patrick, and this is something that Francesco pointed out in the interview, is even though it seems like, okay, from 3% back down to 1.32% or whatever the previous low was in the 10-year yield, doesn't sound like that far to go. It's a big, big move in price to get from here to there. And to get to sub 1% treasury yields, as some people have called for, that's a really, really big move in price. So there's room for the U.S. treasury market to absorb a whole lot of dollars of capital before we get pushed down to super low yields competing with where the low was previously. So we've got a fair amount of room here before we get to that point. And I think, again, the more interesting thing to me is to think about the international dimension of this and how U.S. treasuries are being priced compared to other sovereigns around the world and where those pairs trades are to look at those imbalances. And I agree with you. I know Bill Gross has not done so well with that trade. I think he was early to it. But as I said, if we get to a stock market crash scenario, which suddenly drives European sovereign debt deeply negative, I think that's going to be a shorting opportunity because it won't make sense for it to be there. It'll be there because money coming out of the stock market had to go somewhere before somebody could figure out what else to do with it. And I think that sets up a really ripe short if it happens. Of course, that's all predicated on Francesco being right that there's a stock market crash coming. Frankly, I haven't been anticipating a crash. I'm anticipating more of an unwind as quantitative tightening continues to be applied, and it looks like we may see a pause in quantitative tightening, but eventually it will be resumed, and when it is resumed, I think it puts more and more downward pressure on markets. So there's a lot of variables here in terms of how this could all play out.
Absolutely. You know, and that's where I wanted to talk about the stock market on a chart. Now, traditionally, I've put on daily charts and 4-hour charts. So all of our listeners that have seen the past charts know that. But I went and zoomed really out. I wanted to put a weekly chart of the S&P 500 going back to 2016, just to kind of get a bigger bird's eye view of how this entire market move has played out. And really, I drew on two analogs of how there's two very different perspectives on what is about to happen. You know, one is this view, which is in the green, which is the idea that we're going to have a continuation of the bull market. And then you have like the Brent Johnsons and I guess you were suggesting Marco Kolonovic is in that camp, where this idea that we'll have still a break to higher highs in the coming months. And I wanted to compare that to the scenario, which I often have a much stronger bias for, which is that this was simply a very violent bear market rally for a bear market that is already well underway, and that eventually this is just going to roll over as we get into the second quarter of the year. And I sort of wanted to draw the two scenarios. I always approach this, you know, we have to have a narrative, an idea of what we want, but we also have to stress test that against the unfolding reality of how the price action is behaving. And this is sort of like a roadmap of what I would expect to see if in fact one is playing out more than the other. So to me, I still have the bias that this thing rolls over here and that we are not going to approach the previous highs. But really, if we start seeing price action north of 2,800, and more importantly, every sell-off that occurs is being defended at those levels, that would really have to open my scenarios up to the idea that maybe there is still one more leg higher, but I'm not going to go into it with that.
Well, and I think it's absolutely essential to stay open-minded here. I certainly thought when the VIX complex broke down that that was the beginning of the end. I knew there had to be a relief rally coming off of that, but I didn't think we'd get to new all-time highs, and we did. So, you know, to say now, oh, that's it, the high is in, I'm sure of it. And well, I've been sure of it before, and I've been wrong. So I do not want to go outright short this market at this point. We're already past 61.8% Fibonacci retracement. It's not shown on this chart, but we're past the 200-day moving average. We're at a point where there's one more technical level. If you look at those three tails that are sticking up on the S&P chart there just after the first big break in October, if you extend those three tops and draw a trend line across, it would hit the current market at about 2790 or so. So is that an attractive level to short from? Normally looking at this chart, I would say, yeah, it probably is. But having been proven wrong a few times, I don't want to go outright short. So I looked at what are the most obvious option strategies, and I looked at something like, well, what if I just were to look at December puts out of the money? Patrick, even the deep out of the money strikes, if I look at the December expiry, if I'm trying to put a position on for the rest of the year, are pretty expensive at around $75 or so. If I want to be a little bit more in the money or closer to the money, and I just get the 2750 strike, just a little bit below the current market, I'm paying upwards of $150 for that. That's a pretty big downside, a pretty big loss to take if it doesn't go up my way. So what can I do in terms of other option strategies? I'm not convinced it's time yet. It feels to me like it ought to be another 3 or 4 months before this thing really rolls over. But I think it is coming, and I want to have some exposure to the downside, but I don't want to get caught with my pants down if this thing ends up going to new all-time highs, which has surprised me before.
Eric, this is where I want to circle back to a strategy that not only did we discuss several times over the last year on the show, but I also did a special webinar at Big Picture Trading for all of our Macro Voice listeners. And that was the idea of calendar straddling the markets. And I wanted to circle back to it because one question that was asked to me by a number of people back in December was, should I open that calendar straddle as a way to express the short on the market? And my biggest hesitation when the market was at 2,800 just a couple months ago before the big December plunge was the fact that volatility was very high. And when you're putting on a lot of vega risk in your option strategy, and it's actually a larger capital outlay. But this is where I wanted to go to page 4 and touch on where volatility is right now. Obviously, the volatility premium at the different parts of the curve are going to be different, but the VIX is a reflection of the general average volatility for a 30-day option. It's a good way for us to gauge where we are in general volatility conditions. And what is particularly interesting to me is that, you know, back in December, we were at 25 vol before the crash really started. And then even during the decline, we were hitting up in the mid-30s for where volatility was. Today, we find ourselves down in the 15 to 16 level on the VIX. And what's particularly interesting to me about this is that we're now finally back in a period where a lot of that additional volatility premium that was being charged before has now found itself being taken out of the market. And now, is there a risk that the volatility still gravitates back to 12, back to the traditional lower end of the range where we've seen during bull markets? There's always a chance of that. But if you subscribe, in my mind, to the view that this is a bear market, even if you go back to the bear markets of 2000 to 2003, as well as the 2007 to 2009 period, once volatility found a new upper boundary, it never returned back to the bottom end of the range. And so if you subscribe to the view that this is a bear market and that this is a bear market rally, then to be honest, volatility shouldn't go much lower than this. And therefore, we have very little vega or much smaller vega risk than we did putting on this trade at any point in the last 3 months. So to me, I'm once again interested in the calendared straddles as a way of expressing this trade.
So to summarize, Patrick, the reason that the calendared straddle didn't make sense the last time that we were at the current price level is if I look back toward January or so, look at the VIX, which is what really is measuring the cost of options. Options were much more expensive then than they are now. So let's come back now to the calendared straddle. What is that trade? How does it work? What's the rundown?
So on page 5, what I did was I just took a screenshot of a quote on the SPY at the 275. Now, a straddle is simply the purchase of a call and the purchase of a put. It's actually a very straightforward strategy. Often we've criticized the strategy simply because it's like buying simultaneously two airline tickets to two different destinations, but you can only get onto one plane. One of them is certainly going to be a waste of money, right? It was the analogy you shared with us. And it's often, in my mind, better to choose a pure direction for a trade. But one of the things we've done in the past in trying to discover the top of a key reversal is we buy a shorter dated call option, which has a higher gamma, as a way to hedge out buying a longer dated put, which is the one that we're trying to express a bigger bias that the market is going to turn back down. And so by mismatching it, what happens is if we're early in the trade and the S&P keeps ripping higher, the rate of change of the delta on the shorter term call is increasing at a faster rate than you're losing on the put. And this allows us to continuously be able to adjust the trade while trying to discover where the ultimate trading top of the market will come.
So instead of a straddle, outright straddle, which normally is a strategy where you don't necessarily have a view directionally, but you just think it's going to move one way or the other, this is like a straddle with a bias. You've got a view that downside is what you care about, but you just want to make sure you don't get screwed if it turns out going up on you instead.
I don't know about saying screwed. What it is it gives you several shots at trying to determine where the high is ultimately coming in. So it's about you having your foot in the water on a trade, but accepting that you're not going to be perfect about the entry, and it gives you a number of opportunities to reposition on the trade. And so this is something that is an interesting trade to start considering putting on, because even if the S&P, let's say, heads to the 2800 level, let's say the SPYs are trading near 280 and you're 5 points higher, then the money that you're making on the call option is doing a pretty good job at hedging out what you're losing on the put. Now, there are theta considerations. Obviously, if this is dragging its heels to do that, the time decay may erode your position at a faster pace than you're making it on the delta, which means that you might be at a losing position on that. But the only real risk in this trade is if the market just trades sideways. I mean, long as you have some reasonable 50-point swings in the S&P higher and lower, then this is a very interesting way of starting to engage the trade and still not having to be perfect about your market timing.
Okay, Patrick, what you just said logically makes sense, but why these specific strikes and other parameters that you've chosen that we're seeing on page 5 here?
Well, here what I essentially did was I simply just arbitrarily chose a 1 month call option going out to the March 15th expiration. At the time when we were recording this, had 29 days till its expiration. And then at the same time, I went out to the May put option, May 17th expiration, which has about 92 days. So we're matching a 1 month worth of 3 month just for illustrative purposes. And I'm straddling basically at the money. So the SPY at the time that I took the snapshot was trading basically at 275. And so we're matching a 275 call against a 275 put. You're more or less outlaying about $12. I'm rounding it, obviously. But we're more or less, it's going to cost you $4.35 for the call option, and it's going to cost you like $7.65 for the put, and you're outlaying roughly about $12 on the straddle, and you're looking for the next kind of move in the market. And so in this situation, your starting delta is near zero, but the gamma is larger on the shorter term call. And that's one of the big benefits of shorter term options, is that they've got bigger gammas. And so if the most immediate move of the market is a continuation higher, the call option will start to move higher at a faster pace than you're losing on the put. And that's the whole goal, is that if you're early to that bigger picture turn, then you're profiting from the call option, and you're basically not at a loss on the trade, even if the market goes higher.
Patrick, that made perfect sense to me, and I'm sure it made perfect sense to people who are already big picture trading members and graduates of your option training program. But for the benefit of those listeners who were confused by all of the Greek speak and fancy terminology there, tell us a little bit more about the 7-day free trial that you're offering for big picture trading, where you teach people all about the intricacies of option strategies.
Well, the 7-day trial is just an opportunity to have a look behind the curtain at big picture trading, what we do and how we do it, to get access to our daily webinars and the trades that we're putting on. And we're going to be talking about the S&P 500 and how to put on these trades in the coming weeks. So it's an opportunity for people to come and see what I do.
And of course, the information about how to sign up for that is available on slide 6 here, or just by going to bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there in the interest of time. Folks, we need your help promoting Macro Voices, so please tell your friends and colleagues about the show, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, if you haven't done so already, shame, shame, shame on you. Sign up and get your free account at macrovoices.com, which doesn't cost you anything. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email each week. It never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including supporting materials for our podcasts. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview. You'll also find the link to the chart book for Francesco's presentation, as well as the charts we discussed in the postgame. You're also going to find a link to the most recent blog by Kevin at the Macro Tourist discussing Bill Gross succumbing to his nemesis. Also, an article about JP Morgan's Marco Kolonovic's view that the rally has 3 months left to go. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.